Good evening and welcome to Behind the News from March 11, 2004. This is Doug Henwood, and we're looking, as we do most weeks at this time, at the worlds of economics and politics. We've got two interviews lined up for tonight. First, one with Robert Fatten, who is a professor of politics at the University of Virginia and a specialist on a native of Haiti. And we'll be talking to him about the historical and political context for the current crisis in that country. And then a little after 5:30, we'll speak with Hillary Wainwright, who is author of a recent book from Verso called Reclaim the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy, about how popular political movements can engage with the state without getting corrupted or reactionary or any of those terrible things. And before we get to the interviews, a couple of words about the economic headlines. First of all, it was reported this morning that first-time claims for unemployment insurance, that is people who lose their jobs and head over to the unemployment insurance office to sign up for benefits, that count for last week fell by 6,000 from the previous week, and adding to a decline of 4,000 the previous week, and we're now down at 341,000 people who claimed unemployment insurance for the first time last week, considerable improvement from about a year ago when it was about 100,000 a week higher. So we're at a level that's consistent, usually consistent with job growth, a strengthening job market, but that does not seem to have happened yet. We'll be talking about that in just a moment. But it does show that at least the pace of layoffs has been slowing, even though the pace of hiring does not seem to be picking up. It was also reported this morning that retail sales for the month of February in the United States rose 0.6%, although mainly because of very strong performance at car dealers. And the car market, that is automobiles and light trucks, which is what people are buying these days, SUVs, demand for these things has been on quite a tear for years. We've gone essentially 10 years without any kind of recession in auto buying, and that is without any kind of modern historical precedent. Usually that goes up and down around a long-term trend line. It's been way above that trend line since 1992, basically, and it has yet to crack. So it does seem like consumers are extremely extended and have been spending like crazy on valuable items like cars. The car makers themselves have been only selling these things by offering deep incentives, 0% financing and other gimmicks. So they're not making a whole lot of money on the cars they're selling. And also, we learned last week that U.S. households increased their indebtedness last year by the largest amount relative to their annual income in the history of these modern numbers, which began in 1946. So we're people are borrowing like crazy, spending very aggressively, even though the underlying tone of the job market is rather weak, which is a very strange conjunction of events. And either the job market has to improve or people are going to have to stop borrowing and spending. Something's got to give. So we keep saying that. I keep saying that, but it does indeed. In the words of Herb Stein, the Republican economist, father of Ben Stein, if a phenomenon is unsustainable, it cannot be sustained. And sometimes it's sustained longer than it should be, according to Stein's law. But it something's got to give. And then a word about last Friday's jobs report, the employment report, the monthly numbers, very important, very timely, very good measure of what's going on with the economy and also what's going on with most ordinary people whose economic livelihood depends upon their job. And we learned that U.S. employers put on only 21,000 new jobs in February, a major disappointment, a small fraction of what most people, including me, were expecting, and about a tenth, or less than a tenth even, of what you'd expect in a normal month based on long-term historical averages. So very weak performance. And even worse, earlier months' gains, January's payroll gains, were initially reported at 112,000, which was the first six-digit figure we'd seen in a couple of years. I was revised below six digits to 97,000, and the previous month was also revised down a bit. Hourly earnings up just 0.2%, and roughly in line with inflation, meaning that real wage gains have continued to be non-existent. The average U.S. worker saw gains in wages after adjustment for inflation throughout the late 90s into the early part of the new millennium. But those evaporated about a year ago, and we're now stuck with this very weak earnings performance. The number of people who were in the labor market, that is, people who were either employed or actively looking for work and therefore counted as unemployed, that number fell. The so-called labor force participation rate, which is a measure of what percentage of the adult population is either working or actively looking for work, that is the employed plus the unemployed. That's the lowest number since July 1991. And the employment population ratio, the share of the adult population working, is very close to its low for this economic cycle. If there hadn't been such dropouts from the labor force last month, and those people were counted as unemployed, which presumably they are, the jobless rate would have risen to 5.8% instead of remaining unchanged, as it was officially reported at 5.6%. So the U.S. labor market is just failing to recover. Alan Greenspan said today, as our economy exhibits increasing signals of recovery, job loss continues to diminish, but new job creation is lagging badly, the ironic consequence of accelerated gains in productivity. In all likelihood, employment will begin to increase more quickly before long as output continues to expand. We have reason to be confident that new jobs will displace old ones as they always have, but America's job turnover process will never be without pain for those caught in the downside of creative destruction. A couple of comments on that. An ironic consequence of productivity gains. Well, productivity is really all about squeezing more out of an hour's work. Sometimes the workers share in those gains, as they did in the late 1990s, see their wages rise and employment expand, but sometimes they don't share. And that's what's happening today. Their employment is not expanding and their wages are not rising. So there's no irony there. Productivity is all about how much can be squeezed out of a worker, and it's a matter of politics and institutional structures, how those gains are divided. And right now they're being gained by shareholders and managers and not by ordinary workers. Greenspan also said, we have reason to believe that jobs will increase before long. People have been saying this for a couple of years. When is this long-term going to kick in? John Maynard Keynes said to all those who thought the Depression would cure itself, in the long run, his comment, a famous comment, in the long run, we're all dead. And Greenspan is sounding like one of those folks. And it's also interesting that he acknowledged that America's job turnover process will never be without pain for those caught in the downside. It's certainly not without pain for many people. But when you're the chair of the Federal Reserve, like Alan Greenspan, you don't feel any pain at all. Some people are more exposed to pain than others. And in other news, Argentina it remains defiant. It came to a deal with the IMF, but it's still being very, very stubborn with its private creditors. About 2 years into a very conscious decision to default on portions of its debt, and it's been a very, very successful policy. And I want to return to this topic in the next week or two and see what's been going on with Argentina and why and what it might mean. But it does look to me I don't know, the neoliberal order seems to be coming a bit undone. And so I guess say more than next week or two. I also wanted to say a few words about Paul Sweezy, who died on February 27th. This isn't an extended appreciation. Two nice evaluations of his life and work can be found on the web, one by John Bellamy Foster, who is a co-editor of Monthly Review, on the Monthly Review website, which is at monthlyreview, all one word, .org, and another of a memorial to Paul Sweezy can be written by Bob Polin. Can be found on the Counterpunch website, counterpunch.org. But I did want to say a few words, recognize his life and influence on the world, and also to say that I probably wouldn't be sitting here today if it weren't for Paul Sweezy. Sweezy was born in 1910 into a life of privilege. His father was a banker associated with J.P. Morgan, and he went to Exeter and Harvard. But he used that privilege not to profit from it and to reproduce the hierarchies of U.S. society, but instead to try to undermine them. He came of intellectual age during the 1930s, when the world was in depression. This background influenced him for the rest of his life, as he focused on capitalism's tendencies towards crisis and stagnation, which reached historical extremes during that decade. But it was also a time when the bourgeoisie produced some of its finest economists, people like John Maynard Keynes and Joseph Schumpeter, who, though they remained loyal to capitalism, nonetheless took radical critiques of it seriously and asked some serious questions themselves. We don't have anyone resembling them today. Sweezy is probably best known for two books, The Theory of Capitalist Development, which appeared in 1942, and Monopoly Capital, co-written with Paul Baron, in 1966. The first was concerned with the tendency of capitalism to stagnate because of the overaccumulation of capital. That is, capitalists found it ever more difficult to find profitable outlets to reinvest their capital. The result was idle productive capacity, slow growth rates or depressions, and high levels of unemployment. That despite massive unmet human needs and great technical knowledge that offered considerable potential to meet those needs. Monopoly Capital was a study of the early post-World War II U.S. economy, which was dominated by giant firms who acted like near monopolists. Faced with chronic shortage of demand for their products, instead of acting like the classic capitalists of the 19th and early 20th centuries and cutting their prices, which helped drive the economy into deflationary depression in the 1930s, the monopoly capitalists instead raised prices and restricted output. The result was a chronic tendency towards stagnation. Aside from those books, Sweezy is best remembered for co-founding the magazine Monthly Review, which to this day remains a model of popular radical economic analysis. Over the years, it's engaged with many of the issues of the day. For example, even though there's nothing about finance, or very little about finance in Monopoly Capital, Sweezy and his colleagues investigated its growing role in the U.S. and world economies since the 1970s with a remarkable flexibility and openness to the real world. Monthly Review and its associated book publishing house, which was founded because I.F. Stone couldn't find anyone to publish his Hidden History of the Korean War, have also been deeply concerned with the role of imperialism in the modern world, whether it was with the U.S. war in Indochina or the debt crises of the 1980s or the recent foreign adventures of the Bush administration. Though MR's circulation is small, its influence has been felt around the world. People mourn Sweezy's death on every inhabited continent on this planet. Finally, a personal note. In 1981, I was thinking about writing a dissertation on the evolution of American poetry from Ralph Waldo Emerson through Wallace Stevens. Specifically, I was interested in the evolution of the psychoaesthetic of narcissism, which manifested itself in the early 19th century as a grandiose and voracious imperial sensibility, and in the early 20th as a much more withdrawn and internalized and aestheticized thing. I got the idea of tying this evolution to the change in the underlying political economy from one of small-scale competitive capitalism in Emerson's day to the large-scale finance bureaucratic capitalism of Stevens. So I picked up Monopoly Capital and read it. From then on, I was bitten with the political economy bug. I never wrote the dissertation, but I kept reading more deeply in economics and politics and learned from Baron and Sweezy the importance of studying the official economic stats with a careful and critical eye. And also, I learned how much you could learn from reading the business press. 5 years later, I started my newsletter, Left Business Observer, and a year after that, I met Samori Marksman, who eventually gave me this show. So had it not been for reading Monopoly Capital and later Monthly Review as a regular reader, I would probably not be sitting here today. I'm quite sure there are many stories like this around the world. Over the last 5 or 10 years, we've seen an explosion in popular activism around basic economic issues. As much as I admire this movement and consider myself part of it, it sometimes suffers from a lack of historical and theoretical rigor. Paul Sweezy's death should remind us of the importance of thinking carefully about the issues like the organization of ownership, the scale of production, and the nature of investment decisions. In a city, a country, and a world afflicted by massive gaps between rich and poor, and with all the technical and material resources capitalism has given us, we could do so much better than that. Paul Sweezy was a model of how to think and act in this often dreadful, often exciting world. Thank you, Paul.
Arise, ye workers, from your slumbers. Arise, ye prisoners of want. For reason and revolt now thunders, and at last ends the age of cant. Away with all your superstition, servile masses, arise, arise. We'll change henceforth the old tradition, we'll spurn the dust to win the prize. Ah, so comrades, come rally, and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.
As our comrades come rallying and the last fight let us face. The Internationale unites the human race.
And that excerpt from the Internationale as performed by Alistair Hewlett, a Scottish singer and songwriter. I nabbed that excerpt off the web a couple of years ago, and I haven't been able to find the full song, but very tempting little snippet there. And news in Haiti. Today it was reported the new prime minister arrived, someone selected by the U.S. government, essentially, to serve as an interim prime minister until there can be some elections. And also more unrest, more violence as police unrest, as police break up a pro-seed demo earlier today in Haiti as well. So those little bits of news, as we're joined on the line by Robert Fatten, who teaches at the University of Virginia and is author of a book, Haiti's Predatory Republic, The Unending Transition to Democracy. And I tried to get a copy of that book from the publisher, who took a day to respond to my request and then insisted I pay the FedEx bill and then failed to specify for morning delivery. So it didn't arrive in my office by the time I left to come down here. So I'm embarrassed to have to conduct this interview without having had a chance to read some of Robert Fatten's book, but I tried. Welcome to WBAI, Robert Fatten.
Well, thank you, and I'm sorry about the story about that book.
All right. Well, my apologies for not being a more informed interviewer, but let me wing it then. We're certainly seeing a lot of Haiti news in the headlines and on the TV. But you know, the big question is, how did we get to this point? How is Haiti so poor, so and so afflicted by these recurrences of political crises and violence?
Well, I think what you need to do is to go back in history from the very beginning of the country, when the country got its independence, and that's exactly 200 years ago. The nation, by virtue of the fact that the slaves revolted against their masters, well, the nation of Haiti became a pariah nation. The great powers did not want to recognize the independence of Haiti. That in turn generated all kinds of problems for the country, both internally and externally. At the same time, you have to look at what existed then. That was a slave economy, insofar as the plantation system prevailed, and the country was essentially getting its wealth from the sweat of slaves. So when we got our independence, the question became, how would Haiti survive in the context of that global economy? And that became a real problem because we had very few resources. We were essentially marginalized from the international community. So that prompted the problems that we still inherited from that period. And they also, when we look at Haiti, there are conflicts that are very deep in terms of class and in terms of race. And those conflicts were already there at the time of independence.
Let's step back a bit. Who were the original colonists?
The French, and first the Spanish and then the French. So the War of Independence was a war against the French. And the main leaders are obviously people like Toussaint Louverture, Jean-Jacques Dessalines, and Christophe. There were many others, but those are the ones that we've heard a lot of.
And then after the revolution and the independence, did any of them stick around, or did they all leave the island?
The French?
Yeah, the French.
Yeah, the French were essentially expelled from the country, or they died in the process. And that generated a significant conflict between Haiti and the French, insofar as Haiti wanted to be recognized by the French, but after defeating the French, we had to pay the French to get our recognition. And actually, we paid something like 150 million francs at that period to get that independence. And that leads us to some extent to what has been happening more recently. Because you see, the Aristide regime wanted restitution from the French precisely because of the fact that we had to pay so much money to get their independence, and also restitution for the crimes of slavery and colonialism. And Aristide had asked the French to give him something like $23 billion. And obviously the French looked at that and said that this is not going to happen. But the tension between Aristide and the French really crystallized as a result of those demands made by Aristide. And at one point he even lectured in public the French ambassador about the morality of colonialism and slavery. And clearly the French didn't like it.
All right, let's go back to the early history again. Mm-hmm. After independence, Haiti was obviously kind of severed from a good bit of the trade circuits.
And absolutely.
Its whole economic model was overturned. So
yeah.
What replaced it?
Well, it became essentially a peasant economy. There was a redistribution of land, fairly unequal, but nonetheless there was a redistribution of land from the plantations to the Haitian peasantry. So the system for a long period of time was essentially an agricultural system. Then you had at the very top a small elite which has traditionally been involved in the import-export business. And that has very much been the story of Haiti since then.
And who formed that elite? Where did they come from?
Well, that elite was composed of the freed slaves, the major generals, as it were, of the War of Independence, and also the so-called mulatto class, what we call in Haiti the affranchi, in other words, the descendants of slaves and whites, who represented a minority, but nonetheless had an intermediary status between the slaves and the free men. So when independence came, you actually had the emergence of that group at the very top of the social hierarchy. And the country was divided, too, between the South and the North for a while. And the South was, to a large degree, controlled by the mulatto classes, and the North was in the hands of Christophe, and that was, to a large degree, controlled by blacks. And then it fused again. So we've had, from the very beginning, a history of conflicts in terms of ownership of land, in terms of, therefore, class, and also in terms of race.
And then what about Haiti's neighbor, the Dominican Republic?
Well, the Dominican Republic was, for a short while, under the presidency of Boyer, invaded and became part of Haiti for a while. That was from about 1821 to 1844. And in 1844, then the Dominican Republic got its independence from Haiti. And there has always been tension between the two countries, tension in terms of the different colonial experiences. The eastern part of the island, Santo Domingo, the Dominican Republic, was to a large degree dominated by the Spaniards and remained very much in that orbit. And there was clearly a more European population there than in Haiti. And that has generated tension. And more recently, we've had tensions because many poor Haitians moved to the Dominican Republic to work in the sugarcane plantations in very, very nasty conditions. So you've always had tension, and it has been a source of conflict, that relationship between the Haitian workers in the Dominican Republic going there because of desperate conditions in Haiti. And under Trujillo, the former dictator of the Dominican Republic, there was a massacre of Haitians which left, obviously, a legacy that we are still living with to some extent.
And you said after returning to the Haitian economic history, after the independence, it became a peasant economy that was fairly self-sufficient and isolated from the outside.
It was more exactly. We did export some coffee, we did export some sugar, things of that sort. But the economy, the peasant was really involved in his own self-subsistence. You know, the peasants also went to markets to sell their goodies. But on the other hand, it was not very different. It was a very different economy from the plantation economy, completely different. The peasants controlled their plot of land, and essentially subsisted on that. And there were some exports organized by the elite people who would buy coffee or sugar and would try to export it.
And this continued through much of the 19th century?
Yes, that's very much the story. What changed only fairly recently, that was under the Duvalier regime and under Jean-Claude Duvalier, when there was an attempt in the late 70s, mid-70s, to transform Haiti into an export-oriented economy. So they would send unfinished goods to Haiti, in particular baseball and shirts, things of that sort, and Haitians would re-export it as finished goods. But it was an economy based essentially on cheap labor. That was the, if you want to put it in neoclassical terms, the comparative advantage of Haiti at that point, cheap labor. But it didn't really materialize on a wide scale, because you were talking essentially about Port-au-Prince itself, and in the semi-industrialized area near the national airport in Port-au-Prince. And it never involved more than about 200,000 workers. But it did have an impact to some extent on life in the 70s. There was the beginning, if you wish, of a working class. To some extent, that was also one of the reasons that led to the fall of the Duvalier regime, because that experiment did not work, and it eventually collapsed.
I'm speaking with Robert Fatten, who is the author of the Haiti's Predatory Republic, The Unending Transition to Democracy, and a professor of politics at the University of Virginia. When did the United States get involved with Haiti?
Well, the United States was, to some extent, always involved. It depends on what you mean by involved. You see, if you don't recognize the country, I think that's a form of interference in some ways. And there was a real fear on the part of the United States when Haiti got its independence that the example of slaves revolting might, in fact, have significant repercussions in the southern part of the United States. Eventually, the country was recognized in 1862, and the United States actually sent Frederick Douglass as its foreign ambassador to the country. So it came essentially during the period of the Civil War in the United States. But prior to that, there was real antagonism. And more recently, you had the intervention in 1914 that lasted till 1936.
That was an occupation.
That was an occupation, yeah. Then you had the second intervention, occupation, that was to restore Aristide in 94, and then you have the more recent intervention that has happened in the last few days.
Why did the U.S. invade and occupy the first time?
The first time, well, the excuse at the time was that there was disorder in Haiti and that American property was endangered. But that was the period when the United States was involved not only in Haiti, but also in the other areas of Central America. That was the period of the big stick, as it were. So the United States invaded, controlled the country, created an army, did, in fact, to some extent, contribute to better communication. There were roads that were built, etc. But the main legacy was really the army, which was a form of centralized control that would ultimately protect American interests and the interests of the elite, to put it in simple terms.
I should say, this is Behind the News. My name is Doug Henwood, WBAI, New York, 99.5 FM, on the radio dial and on the web at WBAI.org. And I'm speaking with Paul Fatten, who is the author of Haiti's Predatory Republic and a professor at the University of Virginia. Now, I presume that with the United States invested in Haiti and occupying Haiti, Haiti was no longer a self-sufficient peasant economy. What was the model then?
You still had a lot of that because, there's a proverb, it's a word in Creole, which gives you the idea of how the country was organized. It was called Moon en dehors, and that's essentially people outside the system. And Moon en dedans, that means people within the system. Now, the peasantry always paid taxes in disproportionate amount, but it was not necessarily included in the economy that was mostly concentrated in Port-au-Prince. Now, there was coffee production, there was sugar production, but that did not necessarily involve the whole peasantry. There's a significant portion of the peasantry which survived on subsistence economy. So the investments were, there were investments in the sugar, what was called La Asco, and that was the main sugar company, but that has disappeared since then. And in one of the ironies of Haiti now is that we, to some extent, import sugar, which is kind of unbelievable. But the investments in Haiti were not huge either. There were some strategic interests at the time, and those interests were revived, obviously, during the Cold War and the emergence of the of Cuba as a main point of conflict between the Soviet Union and the United States.
And now let's move ahead considerably and talk about the emergence of Aristide. Where did he come from? Talk to us about his first taste of power.
Yeah, well, Aristide was known in Haiti in the 80s as someone who had always opposed the Duvalier dictatorship and someone who had opposed the different military regimes that followed the departure of Jean-Claude Duvalier. He became, to some extent, the voice of the poor. He was at the time a priest. He came from the lower classes, and he espoused a combination of populism, theology of liberation, and some socialistic tendencies. He was not, before the elections that led to his victory, he was very skeptical about the whole political process. And it's only at the very last moment that the left in Haiti mobilized around the candidacy of Aristide. So he became the figurehead, as it were, of what was then called and is still called the Lavalas movement. And Lavalas is a word in Creole which means the flood. And the idea behind the name was that the Lavalas movement would clean the country from all the rubbish that existed under Duvalier and the military. So the elections took place in 1990. Aristide won an overwhelming number of votes. I mean, he was close to 70%. He was clearly an extremely popular fellow among the lower classes. He was always despised by the elite, even then. There is one important event that will illustrate to you the difficulties that I see that from the very beginning. He was elected in December of 1990, and he was inaugurated in February of 91. But in that period, there was already an attempted coup against Aristide. The coup had been fomented by a fellow who was a head Makout, and that was Roger Lafontaine. Now, the coup did not succeed to a large degree because people in the slums of Port-au-Prince moved in the thousands in front of the National Palace to make it clear to the military that the coup would not stand. And ultimately, Aristide was inaugurated in February of 91, but he didn't last very long. 7 months afterwards, he was overthrown in a military coup.
And now that he came back to power, some people are saying that as good as he was the first time, he'd developed a taste for corruption and authoritarianism is no longer the good guy that he was seen as 10 years ago. What do you say to that?
I think this is quite true. I mean, I think if you looked at the government, transparency had disappeared. For instance, when Aristide was first elected in 1990, he put forward all of his wealth. He had no wealth, actually. He had about $500, and that was that. Now, when he came back, that kind of transparency fast disappeared. There was corruption. There was also a drift to authoritarianism. One of the But one has to put that also in perspective. Aristide, when he came back, was a different person. He had to make significant compromises with the United States in order to come back. So many people who had, in fact, fought against Aristide became part of his government. It was also a compromise with the International Monetary Fund, the World Bank, etc. And those policies of structural adjustment, clearly represented a significant problem for any regime that wanted to have at least some kind of populist support. But there was the drift towards authoritarianism. Aristide was obviously afraid of a potential coup, even though he disbanded the army. So he started to create what you may have heard about, the Chimère, well, to a large degree, young unemployed men in the slums, and they were actually his enforcers. Initially, I think he created the Chimère to consolidate his power and to intimidate anyone who might think about a coup. But with the passage of time, those Chimères became powers unto themselves, and some of them actually bypassed Aristide. If you look at the beginning of the armed rebellion that ultimately led to his downfall, well, that initially started in Gonaïves by former supporters of Aristide, former Chimères. They were quite displeased by the fact that their former leaders, a fellow by the name of Amio Metayer, was assassinated. And the followers of Metayer in Gonaïves were convinced that it was the government, and in fact, maybe Aristide himself, who ordered the murder. So his brother, Buteur Metayer, began to fight against Aristide, and they took Gonaïves. Immediately after that, then you have a different story that unfolds, because you have former military people who were involved in Frappé, which was a paramilitary death squad, who enter the country from the Dominican Republic and get and join, actually, the forces of Metayer, and that was the so-called cannibal army. As it were, the rest is history. They move very quickly to take virtually the northern part of the country in a matter of weeks, that eventually led to the fall of Aristide.
We're just about out of time, but certainly it looked like the United States gave Aristide his walking papers. What do you see developing from here?
Well, it's going to be a very complicated situation, because Aristide still has followers, in particular in the slums of Port-au-Prince. This is a reality that any government will have to confront. And then you have also the paramilitary groups, which are armed. So if you want to have any type of development in the country, you need at the very least to disarm all of those fellows. But then you need to deal with the huge problem, which is essentially a problem of poverty and the great divide that exists between the elite and the vast majority of Haitians. Until you do something about that divide, we will probably move from crisis to crisis. So this is ultimately the key issue. How do you have some economic growth, and how do you address the fundamental inequities that exist in Haiti?
And, of course, that's not something that's very high on the Bush administration's agenda, I would imagine.
That is absolutely right. And any structural adjustment program would inevitably, in the context of Haiti, probably aggravate those inequities, even if there is economic growth. So the best that one can hope, given the constellation of forces in Haiti and the constellation forces in the region, is a government that would be more or less competent, a government that would be honest, and that would at least have some reformist leanings in terms of serving the basic needs of the population. When I'm talking about basic needs, I'm really talking about basic needs. That is to say, clean water, primary education, basic health care. So they're very basic things. And so far, we haven't had any regime really concerned about those basic necessities for the vast majority of the population. And the conjuncture now is one that does not invite a lot of optimism.
All right. Well, thank you for joining us.
Okay, thank you very much.
Robert Fatten. I've been speaking with Robert Fatten, who is the author of the book Haiti's Predatory Republic, published by the not very radio-friendly Lynn Reiner Publishers in Colorado. And he also teaches at the University of Virginia. Back with Hillary Wainwright after this word from the Gang of Four. And that was the Gang of Four, their classic 5:45 about watching the news. And this is Doug Henwood. The show is Behind the News, WBAI in New York, 99.5 and your FM dial. And we're now joined by Hillary Wainwright, who is the editor of the magazine Red Pepper and author of a book published last August, I think, by Verso called Reclaim the the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy. Welcome to WBAI, Hillary.
Hi, Doug.
I think the last time you were on the show was talking about the political troubles of Tony Blair. So before we get to before we get to talking about reclaiming the state, how is the master of the British state doing right now?
Well, not very well. I mean, the people of Britain are not happy, and I think they're sort of seeing through him in the way that people here are seeing through Bush. I mean, there's always been a minority, but here in Britain, on the 15th of February, you know, you had a massive, massive demonstration, and the majority of people were against the war. And now, you know, Bush is, not Bush, but Blair, I mean, they kind of blur together, but Blair's constantly trying to say, it's over, enough is enough, let's move on. And he just can't move on. I mean, his Hutton inquiry, which, you know, was really, from the start, intended as a whitewash, people just wouldn't accept. And so he had to do another inquiry, which, you know, people aren't going to accept because it's been held in secret. So I think he's now his last ultimate desperate card is just trying to appeal to people, Labour supporters, Labour Party members, look, unless you support me, we'll get the Tories in. But that's a sign of desperation, and people aren't convinced because he's acted so much like a Tory.
Well, his buddy Gordon Brown is waiting in the wings, though, isn't he?
Yeah, I mean, you know, it could be that, I was going to say that there's a sort of deal done with the trade union leadership and the kind of hierarchy of the Labour Party. But actually, I mean, that's the kind of thing that would be done in the Tory party. You know, as soon as Mrs. Thatcher was no longer an electoral asset, you know, the kind of mandarins of the Tory party would get together and put the knife in, and he'd
go. It's the 1922 committee, was it there?
That's something like that.
Yeah, yeah.
But I mean, that the Labour Party is more complicated than that. And Blair, you know, everybody from, I was talking to a previous general secretary of the party, down to sort of local activists, are saying, you know, he's no longer, you know, he's gonna be our downfall. But getting rid of him isn't that easy.
All right, let's move on to your book, which is somewhat more optimistic than studying Tony Blair, I think. Reclaim the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy. You're looking at a lot of contemporary political movements, whatever we call it these days, that are skeptical about the state, skeptical about parties, all these traditional things that we've traditionally associated with politics. But nonetheless, you're not ready, like some neo-anarchist, to discard the state. So how do we balance this? I mean, there's this skepticism, and I think well-earned, about organized parties, the corruptions of institutions, and then the corrupting power of the state. How do we get around this problem? You've been looking around the world at a lot of examples, so tell us, give us some reason for optimism. There is a way to get around this problem.
Well, I think a good example which maybe illustrates the strategy comes from Brazil. I mean, I know, you know, there are problems with Lula now up against the IMF, but looking at what they've done in many cities around the state, I mean, I suppose the principle is that they, and I think this would apply to many of the people that I met in my travels, believe in many of the democratic and egalitarian aspects of the state. You know, the fact that, say, in Britain, you know, you've got a Labour government that then redistributed wealth, you know, created the welfare state. People want that. People want public resources. But they are disillusioned with the way in which those public funds, those public resources have been managed and administered. And so what you've got in many towns in Brazil is a solution which I think provides, not in exact detail, but provides the principles, elements of a strategy, which is, okay, you know, you elect a government with a redistributive agenda, an agenda of, you know, regulating the market and so on. But it's not enough just to elect them. There needs to be much more powerful kind of democracy to follow through the vote, you know, and actually hold the politicians, not only hold them to their commitments, but build up a sort of power that can control the state. I mean, I think what we've learned in the last sort of 50 years or so is that the state isn't a sort of neutral instrument. It's got its own momentum, its own bureaucratic interests. So you need a kind of what I've called participatory kind of democracy, a more regular day-to-day set of institutions that keep the sort of institutions of the state to account. I mean, that's dealing with the more, you know, benign sort of welfare state aspects of state institutions.
Well, when you say participatory democracy, this sounds like an echo of the 1960s. So there's some continuity between the movements of the 60s and those of the present.
I think so. I think the difference is that in the 60s, we, you know, I'm showing my age now, but I think in the late 60s and 70s, we tended to believe that popular movements, that participatory kinds of democracy from below could kind of bypass the state, that some sort of explosion of popular power would produce its own institutions. And I think that, and you know, partly because parliamentary institutions and institutions of representative democracy were so sort of decayed and sort of decadent and hopeless, you know, in the face of corporate power, financial institutions, the American government. So also there were great mass movements at the time. So I think we placed great hope in this sort of spontaneous development of popular movements. But I think what we've learned is that participatory democracy has got to be lasting. It's got to actually take the victories of the suffragettes and the Chartists. You know, it's got to take the vote seriously. So, you know, we've got to win elections, but that's not enough. So I think there's a kind of maturing that's gone on between the movements then and movements now. I think the movements now have got a bigger set of problems because clearly national state institutions, national forms of democracy are not enough. So we've got to think about what kind of international mechanisms.
A lot of these movements you're talking about are, you know, sort of local in their origin and orientation, but nonetheless talk to each other, and they're very linked globally. So how does that work out?
Yeah, I mean, that was happening as I was writing the book, really. You know, I wrote the book feeling that unless the kind of global protests that one saw in Seattle and Washington, Genoa and so on, were kind of rooted locally, you know, they would just become diffuse and disappear into the ether. You know, there'd be no material effect. So I wanted to see what was going on locally and how that could connect with the sort of global movements. And as I was doing that, as I was sort of plodding the streets of Newcastle and Manchester and Porto Alegre in Brazil, the movement that we saw in Seattle and so on was beginning to address its concerns to, you know, how do we go beyond protest? What alternatives? And so you've got the development of these amazing global social forums, which then spawned other social forums that were looking at, you know, what alternative policies, alternative strategies can be developed from our movements, not by sort of handing over to politicians, but actually that we work for and try and implement locally and globally. I was at a talk yesterday at the graduate school, and all the students there were saying we've got to have one of these forums in the United States, the belly of the beast.
We need many things here in the United States. I'm speaking with Hillary Wainwright, who is the editor of the magazine Red Pepper and author of a book published last year by Verso called Reclaim the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy. And what is Red Pepper, by the way?
Well, you've written in Red Pepper. Doug's written in Red Pepper. It's an independent...
That was false naivete intended for the audience.
It's a magazine which is... It's more than a magazine. It's trying to give a voice to the sort of disenfranchised left in the UK. You know, like you in the States, we've got a political system that doesn't give any real voice to minorities, to progressive minorities. And so a magazine seemed a good alternative. I mean, not an alternative to campaigning, but an alternative that helped movements both talk to each other, but also show to the outside world that there is an alternative. And it's one that's sort of rooted in what people are doing and struggling around day to day.
And on the web, it's redpepper.co.uk?
Redpepper, all one word, .org.
.org, okay.
UK.
.uk, okay. So redpepper.org.uk. And let's get back to Brazil, actually. And this is, when you wrote the book, you were quite enthusiastic about the Workers' Party. And now that Lula is in power, he's disappointed a few people. Do you think that disappointment is justified, and what, if anything, does that change the way you think?
Well, I think it wasn't unpredictable, you know, that he'd get into office, and even though he had this fantastic mandate, 68% of the vote, the IMF, you know, isn't interested in democracy and was going to immediately make life difficult for him. I mean, it's bad enough anyway, because although he's president, the Congress is dominated by right-wing political parties. So even within the political system of Brazil, he's not got the power that he needs to achieve the kind of reforms that he's won the election on the basis of. But I think the main thing is what the IMF is doing, which is forcing him to cut back on exactly the sort of programs to deal with poverty that, you know, that people had such hope in. And I think that, I mean, I find it difficult to be sort of judgmental. I mean, because I just think that in some ways the movement internationally has got a responsibility to, in a way, join a pincer movement on the IMF, you know, that the PT and the movements around the PT, like the landless movement and so on, are fighting hard. And I think Lula, you know, perhaps not enough, but he does more than most left political leaders constantly sort of attempt to support the movements, like the landless movement. He'll make it clear that he supports their demands. And I think that, in a way, we need to be doing more to expose the role of the IMF, to put pressure on the IMF to sort of build up an international movement of support for what the PT is trying to do. So, I mean, I'm disappointed to a degree, but I can understand why it's happened, and I think we've got a responsibility internationally to shift the balance of power against the IMF globally so that Lula and the PT aren't sort of isolated.
I've said we're out of time, but you'll be at the Socialist Scholars Conference this weekend.
I will.
As will I. So anyone who's going to be going to Cooper Union on this weekend to the Socialist Scholars Conference can hear more of Hillary Wainwright, more of me on Saturday morning at 10 o'clock. And you're don't remember what time you're on, but people want to check it out, socialistscholars.org on the web. Conference opens Friday night at Cooper Union in Alfaster Place in Lower Manhattan. And the book, Reclaim the State, Experiments in Popular Democracy, Hillary Wainwright, published by Verso. That's it for me, Doug Henwood. Stay tuned for the news, and I'll be back next week. And let's go out with this completely apolitical, irrelevant song by Captain Beefheart. That was the Gang of Four. Let's get the old captain this time.
Distant cousins, there's a limited supply, and we're down to the dozens, and this is why. Big-eyed beans from Venus, oh my, oh my. Boys and girls, Earth people around the circle, mixtures of man alike. Big-eyed beans from Venus, don't let anything get in between us. Beam in on me, baby, and we'll beam together. I know we always been together, but there's more. Mr. Zoothorn Rollo, hit that long lunar note and let it flow. Your wallets flop out and women open your purses. Cause a man or a woman without a big-eyed bean from Venus is suffering with the waste, that's a case.